It is the morning of the 15th of December, 2008, and Kevin Moran of Tara Street Fire Station is on duty as a controller. The emergency phone line rings at 4 minutes past 10. It's a 999 call. As Kevin answers, he hears a man. He is struggling to breathe, almost gasping for air. When he speaks, his voice is high-pitched. The man sounds hysterical. "My wife has been attacked," the caller says. Kevin asks the man for his address and tells him to calm down. He tells him to breathe. The man manages to say two words of his address: Rowan Hill. Kevin asks what has happened. The man tells him someone has attacked his wife at their home, Rowan Hill, on the Hill of Howth. Kevin asks if the woman is conscious. The man on the phone thinks his wife is still breathing. Kevin pushes for a certain answer. Is she conscious? The man asks how can he tell. Kevin tells him to check the woman's breathing. Kevin asks the man to confirm his wife was attacked. Yes, the man says. Kevin tells the man to stay on the line and asks if he is able to perform CPR. The man said he isn't. He has never done it. Kevin tells the man he can talk him through it. He hears more heavy breathing. He hears dogs barking in the background. The man tells him he's been attacked too. His head and face are injured. Kevin tells a colleague to call the Gardaí as he talks the man through the CPR, step by step. Pinch the nose, blow one breath, then a second. Place the palm of your hand on her breastbone. Push down 2 inches, firmly. And do it again. And again. Kevin tells the man he is doing really, really well. He tells them there is a fire engine and an ambulance on the way. Help is coming. I'm not getting anything, the man repeats. His wife is unresponsive. Kevin hears the man panic. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story. And now, I'll tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, Celine Cawley, Vale of the Seat, a death in a rich suburb of Dublin, and an investigation hampered by lies, misleading information, and a hidden love affair. At 10 past 10 on the morning of the 15th of December 2008, a Garda car pulled up to the entrance of Rowan Hill, a detached home on the secluded and winding Wingate Road on the Howth Peninsula in Dublin. Garda Colm Murray and Sergeant Brian Clune couldn't see much. The home was concealed behind electric gates that were 6 feet tall, and the gates were closed. Garda Murray scaled the gates and ran towards the house to get the access code. He ran through the open front door and into the kitchen, where he met a man coming in through a back door. The man was unsteady. He stumbled. Garda Murray saw he had scrapes on his head and blood on his face. The man wasn't making any sense. He was hysterical. The guard could see something else, outside the back door. About a meter away from it, lay a woman. He could see she was badly injured, there was a lot of blood, and he couldn't see any sign of life. He noticed a brick on the ground. It too was stained red. Beside the woman was a cordless phone. The man had been speaking on it just moments earlier to Kevin Moran at Tara Street Fire Station. Kevin was still on the line. Garda Mori got the gate access number and ran back to let his colleague drive in. He punched in the numbers 1962 and the gate slowly opened. Later, the Gardaí would learn the significance of that code. It was the birth year of the woman lying on the patio, 46-year-old Celine Cawley. Gardaí soon established that the man with scrapes on his face was Eamon Lillis. He was the 51-year-old husband of Celine Cawley. Eamon continued performing CPR on his wife, assisted by Sergeant Clune, who took over chest compressions. More Gardaí arrived, along with an ambulance and a fire brigade. As paramedic Stephen O'Reilly bent down to tend to Celine's injuries, he was struck by something odd. She was cold. Gardaí and emergency services had arrived 10 minutes after Eamon's emergency call. Celine's body shouldn't be that cold if the attack took place just before Eamon had dialed 999. Gardaí noted down everything Eamon told them. He said the man who attacked his wife was wearing a balaclava. He had used a brick to attack the couple, first hitting Celine and later Eamon when he tried to intervene. The man then fled on foot. Gardaí began gathering evidence and searching for the attacker. Eamon's fingers were bandaged by the ambulance workers. One of his nails was hanging off. They treated him for scrapes to his face and bruising before allowing him to leave the house to speak with Gardaí at Holt Garda Station, where a more detailed statement would be taken. Celine was rushed in an ambulance to Beaumont Hospital. Paramedics tried to resuscitate her again on the journey, and yet again when she arrived in the hospital. But the strain on her heart from her injuries and blood loss was too much. Celine Cawley was pronounced dead at 10:56 that morning. Around the same time, Eamon Lillis was in an interview with Detective Sergeant Endemol Ryan. He went over what he had seen, how he had interrupted an intruder standing over his wife, how the man in the balaclava had run away, how he was possibly masked because the couple might know who he was. This information brought Gardaí to the door of Stephen Larkin, a man who worked as a landscape gardener, who once had worked on the gardens at Rowan Hill. Stephen was at home with his mother. It was 11:20 a.m., just 70 minutes after Celine had been attacked at her home, and 20 minutes after she was pronounced dead. Larkin was 30 years of age and had, at times in his younger years, been on the wrong side of Holt Gardaí. But that was then. He was a respectable gardener now, and more importantly, he said, he had nothing to do with Celine Cawley's death. Gardaí asked Larkin if he knew Celine Lillis, using her husband's surname as they asked. Larkin said he didn't. He didn't realise they were talking about Celine Cawley and Eamon Lillis. He did a few days' work for them 4 times a year and always got on well with Celine. He didn't know her husband. Stephen's mother, who was in the room for the questioning, started to get upset and cried. Stephen said his mobile phone records would show he was at home all morning. Gardaí also took a sample of his DNA and then left. Stephen was left confused, with no idea why he had been targeted. Back at Holt Garda Station, Sergeant Endemol Ryan told Eamon he could call staff at the company where he and his wife worked, an advertising production company called Toytown Films. It was Celine's business, and Eamon worked there. He had been made a partner. Eamon called the company and spoke to a woman on the phone. He told her someone had attacked Celine at the house, but she was in hospital and would be okay. But by then, Celine was dead. As Eamon spoke, he didn't know his wife was gone. Gardaí acted quickly with the information provided by Eamon. A helicopter was dispatched to search across Howth in the hunt for the masked intruder. A Garda statement was shared with the media just before 1 p.m, alerting the public to an assault at a home in Howth. A press briefing was then held at Clontarf Garda Station at 4:30 that afternoon. Later that day, Eamon Lillis gave Gardaí his formal statement, the first of two handwritten statements he would provide. He recalled his morning up to the point he had called 999. He said he got out of bed in his upstairs master bedroom at 6:30 that morning and did some sit-ups. It was his daily routine. He made 3 cups of tea at around 6:50, then let the family's 3 dogs out, before he brought the cups to his wife and their daughter, 16-year-old Georgia. Celine had a cold, so she slept downstairs the previous night. He didn't mention that he and Celine, although married for 17 years, mostly slept in separate bedrooms. While her cold made her snoring louder than usual, the sleeping arrangements harked back to times when the two would have different working hours, and the one to rise the earliest didn't want to wake the other. He also didn't say that Celine hogged the bedclothes. Eamon said he watched television in Celine's bedroom that morning with his wife and daughter until 7:40. Georgia loved to sit in bed with her mother in the mornings and watch GMTV or Good Morning Television, fronted by Eamon Holmes and Lorraine Kelly. It was something the two always did together. After showering, Eamon dressed. He had brought the clothes he was wearing to the Garda station, a grey hooded sweatshirt, grey t-shirt and green combat trousers. Eamon said he then brought Georgia to school. She was wearing a school hoodie with her surname, Lillis, on the back. She had exams that day. It was around 8:20 when Eamon bumped into an old college friend at the school. That friend was the vice principal. They had talked about Christmas preparations. Eamon told his friend the Christmas lights he had put on the tree the previous evening had blown. The old friends laughed. Eamon said he would have to buy new bulbs for the bare tree in their living room. Christmas was only 10 days away. Eamon then stopped at a local shop and bought a newspaper, the Irish Times, something he did every day, and then he drove home. He unlocked the gate and drove in. As he did, the family dogs ran up to his car. He decided he would take them for a walk. Eamon walked into the washroom of their house to grab their leads. He went in through an outside door from the front of the house. He didn't see Celine and didn't expect to see her until later that day, when a meeting was scheduled at 2:00 with their pension provider. He did hear the water pump, he thought. It was loud, meaning someone had recently used the shower. Eamon and Celine had 3 dogs. Molly, a Newfoundland, who was old, arthritic, and not great for long distances. Sam, a Rhodesian Ridgeback. And Harry, a Cocker Spaniel. With them, Eamon walked their usual route to Howth Hill, just up the road from their home. He got back to the house around 9:30. Celine had left a bag of rubbish out for him to put in the bin. When this was done, he walked into the kitchen from the washroom. From there, he saw a man on top of his wife out on the patio. Eamon told the Gardaí he didn't know what the man was doing. He said the man was interfering with Celine's top. Eamon said he had charged out the back door, roaring at the man. Eamon said he startled a man who swung at him with a brick, and that's when Eamon fell and hurt his fingers. The assailant had fled. But Eamon had details that might help Gardaí trace Celine's attacker. He said the man was wearing a ski mask, a professionally made one, not a homemade balaclava. The man wore gloves too. Eamon thought they might be nylon. He was wearing jeans and about the same height as Eamon, 5'11" tall. The attacker was a strong and wiry man, Eamon said. He estimated he was aged somewhere between 20 and 30, and he speculated that the attacker had run down the garden to the back and scaled the 6-foot fence there to make his escape. Eamon and Celine had had the fence installed after their home had been burgled. Eamon wondered if maybe this was the same man. Eamon said he felt numb when he saw his wife lying on the patio. She wasn't moving. He called 999. Celine had exhaled when he performed CPR on her. At noon that same day, the family's doctor called Eamon to deliver the news that Celine was dead. Eamon was prescribed Valium and sleeping tablets to help him cope. He needed to be with his daughter. But they couldn't go home. Not yet. Rowan Hill was a crime scene. Eamon wrote in a formal statement that afternoon, "Celine is a fighter, a tough nut. She would have confronted someone. She wasn't a wallflower," he wrote. In the meantime, Gardaí searched for CCTV footage to see if the assailant showed up across the day's footage from around the local area. As they viewed footage taken from the Summit shop, they saw Eamon. He was buying his newspaper at 8:35 that morning, just as he had told Gardaí. The footage was clear and Eamon was easily identifiable. And then the watching Gardaí noticed something else. Eamon had handed in his clothes at Haute Garda station that morning. The clothes he had told them he was wearing when he found Celine. The clothes he was wearing when Gardaí arrived. A grey hoodie and green combat trousers. But there in the CCTV footage, he was wearing something different. Dark jeans and a black jumper. Gardaí searched for a reason behind it all. For some idea of why someone, whoever it was, would invade a quiet home in a quiet area at that time of the morning and attack a woman. A burglar may be one explanation, but there could be others they were yet to uncover. As part of that, they looked into Celine's life to see if they could identify if anyone might have held a grudge against her. She was a successful businesswoman with a nice family and a lovely home. They took forensic tests of the red-stained brick and scraped under her nails for DNA evidence that might reveal the killer's identity. As word of the killing moved across the town, the local community in Holt was in shock. Then, as it is now, it was a quiet peninsula, a small town jutting out into the Irish Sea from Dublin's northeast coast. Although just a half-hour drive from Dublin's city centre, it feels much further removed. The town is built on a hill, rising from the sea and dotted with beautiful natural scenery, from the woodlands to the sheer cliffs. It's a place where history and memory and old myths remain part of everyday life. From the ruined abbey built in the 15th century, sitting just metres from the centre of the town, to Aideen's grave, a large stone tomb built as far back as 2500 BC, and today just lying off the local golf course. The village grew from the harbour, which was built in 1807, and soon stretched up the hill, where large homes were built looking back across Dublin Bay. Those homes would command a hefty price tag, and few places were as sought after as Wingate Road, home to Eamon, Celine, and their daughter, Georgia. Wingate Road was quiet, narrow, and winding. The shadows of old trees gave it a tranquil, closed-in feeling. High stone walls concealed many of the large and beautiful homes, each sitting back from the road on a generous patch of land. Celine and Eamon's home, Rowan Hill, sat on an acre of mature gardens, with views over Dublin Bay. The four-bedroomed house was surrounded by manicured lawns and stables. A hot tub and a life-size ornamental cow statue sat among the garden's carefully constructed planting design. Neighbours on the secluded road largely kept to themselves. They might go long stretches without bumping into each other. In the days that followed the news of her death, some neighbours spoke to reporters and remarked that Celine and Eamon had dogs who barked if anyone walked past their entrance. Some knew Celine kept horses, and she was involved with the local yacht club. Another neighbour wondered if that time of the year, with homes full of Christmas presents, made them a target for burglars. Members of the public were called on to share any information or sightings of a man around 5 feet 10 or 11 inches in the vicinities of Wingate Road and the surrounding areas close to the summit of Howth. As news of Celine's death became a national story, Eamon Lillis sought comfort in the home of his in-laws. His father-in-law, and Celine's elderly father, James, was a retired solicitor, and he had been with Eamon at the Garda station. That evening, Eamon went to stay at Celine's brother's house in Howth. When Eamon arrived at Chris Cawley's house, his daughter Georgia ran down from her cousin's room and into his arms. Celine's family left the pair to grieve together. Eamon and Celine met through mutual friends at an advertising festival in 1990. That year, the Shark Awards, an event that attracted the who's who of Ireland's advertising industry, was held in Kinsale, a beautiful fishing town in County Cork. Celine was working as a producer for GPA Films at the time, a company run by veteran producer and director Jerry Paulson, who had seen potential in Celine when she worked on the reception desk of Windmill Lane, an iconic Dublin studio. Paulson mentored her into a career in television production. He was impressed by the young woman from Dublin, who had a knack for balancing budgets and driving a hard bargain. She was based in London, and her rise in the company found her working on hit British shows like London's Burning and a detective series called Pulaski. Celine's career in television production was a pivot for the young 20-something, who had up to then carved a successful role in modelling, taking her across the world for big fashion houses like Chanel, Christian Dior and Pierre Cardin. She had also dabbled in acting, with a small non-speaking role in the 1985 James Bond movie, A View to a Kill, where she played one of the girls, a group of young, beautiful women tasked with throwing admiring glances at Roger Moore, who played the 007 character, as he passed them in a party scene. Celine Cawley was born in June 1962 to James and Breda. She was the third child of four siblings. She had two sisters, Susanna and Barbara, and a brother, Chris. They lived in a large home in Portmarnock, a seaside town just a little north of Howth, along the coast. The Cawley children had a loving and financially secure upbringing. James, their father, had his own legal firm called Cawley Sheeran Wynne. He specialised in corporate law and was well connected in business and political circles. One of his partners was the former Ireland rugby player turned business and media tycoon, Anthony O'Reilly. Celine was popular and outgoing and lived the life of someone born into wealth. Boarding school and summers at holiday homes in the south of France, with her free time spent enjoying sailing and riding horses. After studying in UCD, Celine worked as a receptionist at her father's law firm when a photographer taking corporate shots inquired if she had considered modelling. She was tall and slim, with long brown hair and big brown eyes, and very quickly, with a new portfolio, she started to rapidly rise in Irish modelling, with a signing to one of Dublin's most high-profile modelling agencies, the Nan Morgan Agency. From there, and still in her early 20s, Celine decided to try her luck in New York. It was 1982, and her father's connections found her staying with some business associates, who happened to be the parents of the fiery tennis star, John McEnroe. When Celine was discovered by Johnny Casanova of the famous Elite Model Agency, Her profile started to grow stateside, with contracts for shoots in Elle magazine and American Vogue. And while she rubbed shoulders with stars like Bruce Springsteen, she wasn't starstruck by the celebrities she met. She was quoted in the Sunday Independent as saying that Brooke Shields, a top model and actress in America, was an airhead who was getting heavy on the hips. When Eamon Lillis came into her life in 1990, Celine had left modelling and her jet-set lifestyle to pursue her television career. Eamon was 5 years older than Celine, but from an equally quaint part of Dublin, the leafy suburb of Terenure. A football match had been organised as part of the Shark Awards. Ireland's first ever World Cup qualification that year had ended on a high, and Jack Charlton was going to coach a team of advertising executives for the game. Eamon wanted to be on the team, and Celine was the organiser. Once they had been introduced, the conversation flowed. They both loved dogs. Celine had a new German Shepherd Ridgeback Cross, and Eamon had a German Shepherd. They agreed to meet back in Dublin. Celine said that night that she had met the man she was going to marry. While Celine had grown up confident and outgoing, as a child Eamon was quiet, a bit of a loner, and seen as something of a dreamer. Eamon loved reading. James Bond novels were his favourite. He wrote short stories and drew often brilliant sketches. Inside the garage of his childhood home, he painted a large mural depicting the Battle of Britain. He didn't share many interests with other boys his age. Eamon dreamed of being a journalist, but a course in the Rathmines College of Commerce didn't work out, so he went to UCD to study arts in English literature. He was 18, and his mother, Mairead, who had battled an illness, died. Eamon's father was a former military man who led a strictly regimented life, where all events ran to a strict schedule and displays of affection were scarce. After the death of his mother, Eamon's family unit started to fall away, with all three children moving out of the home. Eamon developed a love for words and wrote poetry while at college. It was a happier place for him, and he made friends, who he remained close to. After college, he found another outlet for a writer career as a copywriter with an advertising and marketing company, eventually becoming an art director. Eamon and Celine married in 1991, less than 1 year after they first met. They married in Howth Church and had the reception in Celine's family home. She was 26 and he was 32. They bought a small house in Sandymount, another seaside village in Dublin, but on the south side, and Celine soon became pregnant with their daughter Georgia. Around the same time, the young family experienced a setback. Celine's employer, TV production company GPA, was closing. But with the help of her father and brother, she set up her own company called Toytown Films. She asked Eamon to join her, but he wanted to stay with his own career. In the space of a few years, Toytown Films became a success. Based in Windmill Lane, where she once had worked as a receptionist, Celine was boss of her own company producing television and film commercials with clients like Guinness, Cadbury's and Volvo. She earned €500,000 annually. Eamon brought in a further €100,000. They were financially wealthy. They could afford the finer things in life, like a multi-million euro home in one of Dublin's most scenic and sought-after locations. Life was good for the young family when they moved to Howth. They also purchased a holiday home in Biarritz and added to their animal family with horses and more dogs. On the 16th of December 2008, the day after Celine's death, Detective Sergeant Endemol Ryan was at work at Howth Garda Station when a call came through for his attention. It was Eamon Lillis. Eamon told the sergeant that he remembered something that wasn't in his statement taken the previous day. Sergeant Mulryan drove to Chris Cawley's house to hear the new piece of information. Eamon told him that he had passed out for a time after he had been hit and fallen on the decking. He didn't hear anyone running in the woods beside his house, and his attacker had been wearing a bomber jacket, while his balaclava had a white or cream colour running through it. While Eamon's statements helped form a picture of what had happened the previous day, forensic examinations didn't seem to tally with an intruder attacking Celine and making his escape. The decking showed no trace of finger marks, nor did the wire fencing around the property. There were no stray fibres or hair found. Gardaí started door-to-door inquiries to find out if neighbours had heard anything. They also began to focus on whether Celine knew her killer. Whoever had done this to her had attacked her at close range, and there were no signs of a burglary or break-in. One neighbour, Pauline Fraser, heard what she called a high-pitched scream that Monday morning. She remembered it happened at 9:30. It woke her. She said it sounded like a shriek and was out of place on the normally quiet road. And then, 30 seconds later, she heard it again. She thought someone must be in trouble. Eamon repeatedly called Gardaí to find out when he could return to Rowan Hill. Barred from returning, Georgia, his daughter, couldn't even get a change of clothes. She was still wearing her school hoodie with her surname Lillis on the back. She didn't even have fresh contact lenses. Just 2 days before her death, Celine had brought her daughter to Malahide to buy her a pony. Georgia set her sights on one that measured 16 hands from the ground to the top of its shoulders. Mother and daughter were both crazy about horses. It was a love passed down from Celine to Georgia. Georgia loved the pony. She even had a name for her, Bella. But Celine joked how it was a small horse, and they could get it in another size. They left in good spirits with a view to get Bella the following Wednesday. But Georgia never got to return with her mother. While Eamon and Georgia were out of the house, Gardaí searched the home for clues. Every inch of it was photographed and videoed. The minor moments and throwaway mementos of daily life were catalogued one by one in the bleak, cold process of a murder investigation. Gardaí photographed and filmed rooms adorned with Christmas wreaths and garlands, and everyday items like a woman's bag, a newspaper, a teddy bear, and a lottery ticket scattered on a dining room table. They documented the unwashed cups and bowls on the kitchen counter next to a box of cereal. Upstairs, in Eamon's bedroom, they discovered a mobile phone, a second one belonging to him. On the dressing table, amongst loose change, were two pieces of paper. They had been torn from a notebook, with words written in black capitals on both pieces. The notes read, "She will get that wedding dress. She will marry Keith next June. She will send out the invites in January. You will never be with her properly. The only way you can be with her is to live here. Think of the positives in the relationship. You will never take her to France. She will never share your bed. You are running out of time." Gardaí didn't know the meaning of the message. They didn't know if it belonged to Celine or Eamon, but it intrigued them. And there was one area left to check. The attic. Celine and Eamon's attic was a museum of the past they shared with their daughter. Toys Georgia had outgrown had been carefully stored away. Gardaí found a white doll's house and other toys, alongside the less sentimental items, a box of books and a dehumidifier. Sitting among the toys was a suitcase. It was a black Rip Curl case on wheels. Gardaí opened it. Inside was a refuse bag, and inside the bag were clothes. A black jumper, striped boxer shorts and blue jeans. A blue and white tea towel. And they all had something in common. They were all stained red, all covered in blood. And there was more. Other things had been bundled into the bag. Stained kitchen roll, rubber gloves, and some odd food items. A sauce jar and a pot of cholesterol-reducing Benecol yogurt. Outside, forensic teams discovered blood splatter on the walls between the sliding doors of the kitchen and windows of the living room. It was Celine's blood, and it suggested to forensic experts that she had been hit while already bleeding. There was a smear of blood further along the wall, too, a mark from something hurled against the pebble-dashed walls. A weapon, perhaps. As they hauled new clues from the home, Gardaí began to reassess their view of Celine's death. They began to suspect Eamon was more involved than he had let on. The CCTV footage of him wearing different clothing in his local shop now took on a deeper meaning, as those same clothes had now been found bloodstained in a refuse bag inside a suitcase among his daughter's toys in the attic, and cast a new light over the story of a mysterious intruder they could find no trace of. And then came a phone call. It was from someone working at a local salon in Hoth. They told Gardaí there was a woman working there who knew Eamon Lillis. She was a 31-year-old masseuse. Her name was Jean Tracy. Eamon and Celine were clients. The caller told Gardaí Jean and Eamon were having an affair. When Jean Tracy sat down with Gardaí, she painted a very different picture of Celine Cawley and Eamon Lillis' marriage. It was not a happy one, she said. They had even discussed divorce, she told them. Jean was from Nenagh in County Tipperary, but lived in Dublin and worked as a full-time masseuse at the Hoth Salon. She was also engaged to a man 8 years older than her. In October 2008, 10 weeks before Celine Cawley was killed, Jean Tracy sat into the front seat of Eamon Lillis' car, a Mercedes ML. The pair looked at photos of his dogs on his iPod. Celine and Eamon had been clients of hers for 2 years. It was always professional, until that evening. Something had softened between her and Eamon. There was a different atmosphere between them. She noticed he had nice hands. It was back pain that had brought him to the salon. Celine had recommended Jean. The following week, Eamon came for his Friday appointment time and told Jean his shoulders were stiff. This meant she would have to massage the front of his body to address the shoulder pain. As she did, the two caught glimpses of one another. She asked him what he was thinking. "Nothing," Eamon replied. Then he asked her what she was thinking. Jean took his hand and put his fingers on her wrist, where he could feel her pulse racing. "That's what I'm thinking," she told him. She rushed out of the room. The following Friday, they kissed and the affair began. Jean was 20 years younger than Eamon. Celine Cawley had no idea her husband was cheating on her. She was still seeing Jean for her regular massages. The affair was usually confined to secret meetings in car parks and other quiet spots. The Pavilion shopping centre in Swords was a favourite spot, and Eamon's Mercedes-tinted windows kept their antics hidden from anyone passing the car. Once, while Celine was on a trip to London with their daughter Georgia, Eamon brought Jean to their home. He would lavish Jean with gifts, including a new phone when she left her old one at his house. He brought her shopping for a coat in Brown Thomas. Gardaí now had a second phone belonging to Eamon, the one they had found in his bedroom. They had two SIM cards. Their investigations into the phone showed Eamon and Jean exchanged 86 text messages, 4 multimedia messages, and 18 calls during November 2008. In the first 16 days of December, they sent 212 text messages, and made 88 calls. On the morning of the 15th of December, Jean sent Eamon a text at around 10:30. "Everything okay?" she asked. When she heard nothing back, she sent another text just after 11. "Getting a bit worried now, babe. X," she wrote. No response. Jean learned of the burglary from her employer later that evening. She texted again to offer Eamon support, and this time he answered. "It gives me great strength that you are thinking of me," he texted. "It had been a horrifying day, a day from hell," he later added. When she spoke to Gardaí, Jean Tracy told everything about the affair. Now, a clear view of events began to emerge. Tests on the clothes discovered in the attic showed the bloodstaining each item belonged to Celine. And the clothes matched those Eamon was seen wearing in the CCTV footage from the morning of the killing. And Gardaí had found the weapon, a brick wrapped in a tea towel. With all of that physical evidence, now paired with this new knowledge of a secret affair, Gardaí decided it was time to bring Eamon into the station again. But this time, he would enter as a murder suspect. Eamon was still asleep at the home of Celine's brother Chris on Friday, the 20th of December 2008, when Gardaí came for him. At 5 to 7, Gardaí told Eamon he was being arrested. They told him he needed to get dressed and they would drive him to Clontarf Garda Station. On the way, Eamon was asked for the name of his solicitor. He didn't have one. He had never needed one. Someone had once recommended someone, and their name was stored in his phone. Gardaí called out names in his phone book until they hit on the solicitor. He met Eamon at the station. Before any questioning began, Eamon was asked to provide samples for DNA testing again. Gardaí took his fingerprints, and Eamon was informed that they knew about inconsistencies in his story. When Detective Sergeant Fionnuala O'Loghlin and Detective Sergeant Enda Mulryan started the interview just before 11 o'clock that morning, Eamon was not the affable, helpful interviewee Sergeant Mulryan had spoken to earlier in the week. Eamon was heeding the advice of his solicitor. In Abigail Riley's book, Death on the Hill, The Killing of Celine Cawley, she reports how Eamon told the Gardaí, "My solicitor told me to say nothing, so I am not going to answer any questions." When he was told about the CCTV footage and asked about his clothing, he replied, "No comment." He had no comment to make about the bloodstained clothing or why he had changed his clothes that morning. He stuck to his story that he had been walking the dogs and came home to find an intruder. The interview continued throughout the day and into the early hours of the 21st of December, when the topic turned to his marriage. "Was your wife a dominant person, slightly on the bullying side?" a Garda asked. "No," Eamon answered. "Was your wife paid more than you in the business?" asked the Garda. "No comment," Eamon replied. Eamon was asked if he was Celine's lapdog. He was on €100,000 a year, while she was on €500,000. His affair with Jean Tracy was brought into the line of questioning then, before one Garda called Eamon out on the supposed burglary. The Garda suggested that it had all been made up. He pointed out that when a burglar is disturbed, they run, they don't hang around. At 7:15 on the morning of the 21st of December 2008, Eamon Lillis was charged with murder. Eamon was still in custody in Cloverhill Prison when Celine's funeral was held on the 23rd of December. In the run-up to her burial, celebrities in Ireland and abroad who knew Celine paid tribute to her and sympathised with her family. Gay Byrne said he had seen the Cawley family walk their dogs in Howth. His daughter, Crona, was a similar age to Celine and they knew one another. When Roger Moore came to Dublin to promote his book, he was asked about Celine. He said he remembered her well and he remembered her as a lovely woman. John McEnroe, the tennis player, remembered Celine too. He said he was thinking of her parents and called it a senseless tragedy. Hundreds of mourners gathered at the Church of the Assumption in Howth. The choir from George's school sang Take That's Rule the World as Celine's coffin was carried inside the church. Father Kieran O'Carroll, the officiating priest and a family friend, paid tribute to Celine. He said she was a doer with a flair and an ability to get things done with panache and style. Celine's journey through this world is tragically over, but we who are left are called on to continue remembering her with faith and with hope. Georgia was comforted by family and school friends as she said goodbye to her best friend, her mother. She was just 16 years old, and now she was alone. Eamon Lillis spent that Christmas in Cloverhill Prison. On the 30th of December 2008, bail was set, but it wasn't until the 6th of January when he managed to raise the full amount, paying €75,000 himself, with the remaining surety put up by a friend. Wearing a grey hoodie over a white t-shirt, he crouched down in the back seat of the car as he was driven away from the prison. While he waited for a court date to be set, he was free to return to Rowan Hill. He was going home to live with Georgia, who had stayed on in the property with a housekeeper looking after her. In a documentary on RTE Radio in 2024, Georgia described that time of living with her father as weird because he had changed. She told the documentary, Heart and Soul Horses, that she felt her father had died on the same day as her mother, because after that, he was a completely different person. By the time she made that recollection, she was 31 years of age, but the memory of living for a year with her accused father while he awaited trial was horrific, she said. She considered herself an orphan after Celine died. Georgia remembered one happy memory from those early months after her mother's death. She went to Disneyland in Paris with friends during her midterm break. Her aunt Susanna called. She had a horse for Georgia. It was the horse she had looked at with her mother just days before her death at Broadmoor Equestrian Centre. She named the horse Bella. Back at home with her father, there were some moments of tension. Georgia remembered one heated moment where the pair faced down one another. Eamon became angry and kicked over one of the dog's water bowls. Georgia said to him, "Oh, that's how Mum died." Her father squared up to her. Georgia squared up to him, not backing down an inch. She said to him, "Go for it." Georgia felt then that she knew what had really happened to her mother. Eamon tried to contact Jean Tracy after he was released on bail in January. He called her on her phone and called to her home twice. Jean never answered those calls, and when Eamon arrived at her house, he never knocked. He simply drove away. In February, however, they met three times, and each time Eamon wanted to speak about Celine's death. By now, Jean didn't want anything romantic with Eamon. She had left the Haute Salon and was starting afresh in a new job in Inchicore. She didn't want to know anything more about the morning Celine had died. But Eamon insisted. Eventually, Jean called him back, and what he told her was information he had not even shared with Gardaí. A new version of the events that led to Celine's death that morning. He told Jean that on that December morning, Celine asked Eamon to take out the rubbish. He forgot, and he said Celine became angry. She had said he was a terrible husband and that he was useless. A row that started in the kitchen ended up on the patio. Celine had slipped on the wet tiles, and Eamon had made a disparaging remark. He said she was like a beach ball in the way she had bounced back up. This further fueled her anger. The couple exchanged more insults, and Eamon pinned his wife up against the house. They both slipped. Then Celine tried to bite Eamon's finger. He asked her to stop and pushed her away. She hit the ground. Then blood pooled around her head. From there, she slipped in and out of consciousness. They both had injuries, cuts and bruises, as Eamon described them. When Celine came to, the husband and wife agreed on a story to tell their daughter to explain their appearances. They would invent a bogus burglary and an intruder who had attacked both of them. Jean wanted to know about the brick that was stained, the brick Gardaí suspected may have been used as a weapon. Eamon said Celine must have fallen on it when she fell to the ground. Jean wanted to know about the suitcase stuffed with his bloodied clothes. He had tried to hide it and had invented the story about the burglar for his daughter, he said. Jean asked Eamon if he missed Celine. Eamon would say he did, and sometimes he would forget she wasn't there anymore, turning to talk to her, only to realise she was gone. Eamon and Jean met one more time in March, before she cut off all contact with him. Then, in May, when she arrived at her new job, there was an envelope there for her. It was from Eamon, and it contained a 3-page letter with the lyrics from the Beyoncé song Halo printed on it. There was also a diamond Tiffany pendant. Jean brought them both to the Gardaí. Eamon was told to stay away from Jean. Even driving to her home was a breach of his bail conditions, he was told. In April, Eamon closed Toytown Films. He was the only remaining company director, now that Celine was gone. Then, the day before Eamon Lillis's trial began in January 2010, he finally admitted to Georgia, now 17, that there had been no intruder. Celine had slipped on a brick. He brought it into the kitchen, and when he asked her if she was okay, she turned on him. What he called a scuffle followed, and it ended up outside. On the opening day of the trial, at Dublin's newly opened Criminal Courts of Justice, on the 11th of January, 2010, Brendan Grehan, Eamon Lillis's barrister, made 9 admissions on his behalf. One of these was what Eamon had already told Jean Tracy and Georgia, his daughter, that there was no burglar. This was the first time members of the public and the media learned Eamon's story of an intruder was fiction. He at last admitted that there was nobody else present on the morning Celine died, except for him. He admitted he knew how Celine sustained her injuries. He knew when and how she died. And there was more. The court and the public learned Eamon had been cheating on Celine, and that he had lied to Gardaí. For the first time in a murder case, pictures from a crime scene were displayed on wall-mounted screens for everyone in the courtroom to see. Pictures on the screens showed the blood-stained decking, blood-stained clothes, and Celine's blood staining the pavement. It was too much for Celine's family. Her sister, Susanna Coonan, and sister-in-law, Circa Colley, looked away. Her father, Jim, bowed his head while her brother, Chris, covered his eyes. Eamon showed no reaction. He had arrived in court with his 2 sisters, Emily and Carmel, who had travelled from their homes in England. But throughout the trial, he never looked at them or anyone else, including the Colley family. The 999 call was played to the court. Eamon's gasping, panic-filled words as he spoke to the fire brigade operator. Gardaí and ambulance workers who were in Roan Hill gave their evidence from that morning. The video footage of Celine and Eamon's home was played. A tragic home movie of a moment stuck forever in time. There was the bare Christmas tree in the corner of the sitting room. The dirty breakfast dishes. George's bedroom. And then upstairs to the attic. And George's old toys. And then back down into the master bedroom. Ending with the strange sight of the stunning views from its balcony. When it was finished, Justice Barry White asked the jury to leave. He then turned to the prosecution. He wanted to know why the footage needed to be shown. What benefit did it serve, he asked. What has it done other than appease the gruesome appetite of some members of the public to see the home? The judge asked before he added, It reminds me of the show trial that was put on in America not many years ago, the O.J. Simpson trial. When journalists had shared details of the videoed tour of Rowan Hill, demand increased even further for a seat at Court 6 in the criminal courts. Those who didn't manage to get a seat stayed standing at the back of the court. And when this too filled up, people stood in crowds in the corridor outside. Gardaí gave no indication of when Jean Tracy would take the stand. On the day that she did, the first witness was Pauline Fraser, the neighbour who had heard a scream on the morning of Celine's death. Then it was Jean's turn. The media were baffled. Nobody, including the large group of photographers outside, had seen the young woman enter the court. The Gardaí had managed to protect Jean from the media attention. There were no photographs taken of her. The court had already learned much about Jean and her place in the story of the tragedy at Rowan Hill. They had heard details of the hundreds of text messages and phone calls between Eamon and Jean. They knew she had told him she loved him, and he had texted those same words to her. Jean told the court of their affair, when it began and how it played out. She was asked why she waited 2 months to go to the Gardaí when Eamon had told her about his row with Celine. She had said she had hoped that by ignoring him, he would realise she wanted nothing to do with him. But she decided to speak to Gardaí when she received the parcel from Eamon at her new job. That's when it became what she termed problematic. She said she had reached out to Eamon after he was released on bail to find out how she had ended up in a nightmare after Celine's death. She couldn't understand how she had made such a poor judgment of Eamon's character. She spoke to him again to try to get closure. The following day, it was Georgia Lillis's turn to speak. Ellen Ring, senior counsel for the prosecution, the DPP, was concerned for the teenager and her anonymity. She wanted Georgia to be referred to in any media reports as a 17-year-old teenager, with no reference to her relationship to Eamon, her father. Justice White refused. We have to live in the real world, he said, and a 17-year-old girl living with Eamon and Celine would raise more questions if she was not identified as their daughter. The judge and barristers removed their wigs, a move deemed to make the court experience less intimidating for Georgia. She was seated in a room in the building far away from the crowds and tension of the courtroom. Ellen Ring, for the prosecution, skipped over the events of the 15th of December 2008 and asked Georgia about January 2009 when her father was released on bail. Did you speak to him? Ellen Ring asked. Georgia replied, He just told me what had happened between him and Mum. I can't exactly remember. It had just been the world's worst Christmas for me. She added that she was unable to forgive him for his lies. The prosecution's final witness that day was Dr. Michael Curtis, the assistant state pathologist. Celine's post-mortem was on the 16th of December. Celine had been knocked to the ground by a blow to the head. There had been two more wounds on the head that were too high up to have been caused by a fall. Asked if this would tally with Eamon's claims that Celine had slipped, was then pushed against a wall and slipped again, hitting her head on a brick, Dr. Curtis said, In my opinion, that account does not in any way provide a satisfactory explanation of the injuries of the deceased. Celine died from a combination of causes, he said. She had lost blood from the head wounds and been deprived of oxygen. But there was no bleeding inside Celine's skull. It is possible her life may have been saved if she received prompt medical treatment, the doctor added. When Eamon Lillis finally took the stand, the courtroom was silent. He spoke in low, soft tones about his childhood, how he met Celine, their love of dogs, and her business acumen. People leaned forward to hear him. Brendan Grehan told him to slow down. He was speaking too fast. When Eamon got to the morning of Celine's death, he told how, on returning from walking the dogs, he found Celine had been washing out the fridge and was wearing rubber gloves. She asked him if he had put out mealworms for the robins. He told her he hadn't. She asked why not. She had asked him to do it 3 days earlier. He put on old gloves with the intention of removing dog fowl from the lawn. But Celine followed him, he said. She had shouted, "That's just bloody typical of you. You keep forgetting things." Eamon said a war of words followed, but he didn't see her fall. She was holding a brick and was rubbing her head. When he asked if she was okay, she said, "What do you care? What do you care?" Eamon said he grabbed the brick and said, "Why don't you shove this where the sun doesn't shine?" Then the fight got physical. She scraped him. He pushed her. She screamed. On the icy decking, he grabbed Celine's arm. He slipped. Celine fell backwards. He tried to get up. Celine bit his finger. She was moving her head from side to side as she bit. He used the heel of his hand to try and stop her head moving. It smacked her forehead back. Then everything stopped. Eamon had noticed blood. Celine seemed dazed. She had rested her head in his lap. She tried to sit up. He said the pair had concocted a story for their daughter. A burglar had inflicted their wounds. Eamon went to change his clothes and decided they were too bloody to wash. He put them in a bag. When he went back downstairs, he found Celine still lying on the ground. He could feel no pulse. He dialed 999. "It's going to sound awful, but again I assumed Celine was going to be fine," he told his senior counsel. "I went into complete shock. I didn't know what to do." But he had lied to the Gardaí, Brendan Grehan added. He had even gone back with more details. "I felt I had no way out of it," Eamon said. He said he felt completely trapped and could see no way out. He told the court he had boxed himself into a corner. After Ellen Ring questioned Eamon, Brendan Grehan raised an issue with the judge. He had a problem with the prosecution, he said. They had no evidence of a murder taking place. The judge said the jury would be allowed to deliver murder as one of their options. But the other options, the defence argued, now included acquittal if the jury believed Celine's death had been a tragic accident, manslaughter if Eamon's use of force against his wife was in self-defence, criminal negligence if Eamon had knowingly left his wife to die, or manslaughter if the jury believed Eamon had killed Celine but were not convinced by the prosecution that he had intended to do that. The jury of 6 men and 6 women found Eamon Lillis guilty of manslaughter. On the 4th of February 2010, the 52-year-old was sentenced to 6 years and 11 months in prison. Victim impact statements were written by Susanna Coonan, Celine's sister, and Georgia, Celine and Eamon's daughter. But Georgia's was not read out in court. Susanna wrote, "The endless lies and scenarios are all in my mind right now, and that terrifying realization that I will probably never know what happened. Lack of remorse is hard to credit." He had 13 months' opportunity to at least apologize to his daughter and my father. No such apology was forthcoming. Ellen Ring's voice trembled as she finished reading Susanna's words. "Our lives are enriched for having known you. We still miss you and will miss you desperately. We shall open our eyes, smile, love, and go on. All the stars are coming out tonight. They're lighting up the sky tonight for you." The final line was the lyrics from the Take That song played at Celine's funeral. The Cawley family walked from the court arm in arm 35 minutes after Eamon Lillis was taken to prison. Speaking to the media, They thanked their neighbours and friends for the support over the previous 14 months and saved the special mention for four Gardaí who had worked on the case. Superintendent Dave Dowling, Detective Inspector Angela Willis, Detective Sergeant Fionnuala Olohan and Detective Sergeant Gary Kelly. Celine's brother Chris told reporters his sister was a dynamic, kind, successful, fun-loving and caring person. He said she had lit up so many lives. With his final words and with his voice giving way to emotion, he simply said, "Celine, we love you." One other person to speak that day was the brother-in-law of Stephen Larkin, the innocent man from Hoth, who Eamon had initially told Gardaí he suspected of being the intruder that morning. Larkin's brother told RTE's Liveline that the accusation, although totally baseless, had ruined Stephen's life and had made him a pariah in his hometown. Larkin himself would years later speak of how the false accusation had marked him in the small Hoth village. He said the gossip around him led to him becoming suicidal. He remained angry that Eamon Lillis was never made to answer for why he had falsely accused him. Although Eamon was jailed, the Cawley family had to live through a second legal trauma. Celine's brother and sister, and Georgia, took a High Court action challenging Eamon's right to any share of Celine's assets. But they lost. Even in jail, Eamon Lillis was a wealthy man, with more than 1.3 million euro to his name. In 2024, following the RTE radio documentary, Georgia managed to finally buy a new place for her equine therapeutic business. Although her father had been released from jail, there was no contact between them. Instead, she remembered the loving relationship she had had with her mother. The last she saw of her father was the day of his sentencing in court. As he left the family home in Hoth, he had put 50 euro on the table for her. Hours later, he was taken to prison. Georgia remembered that her mother had left her a lifetime of happy memories, including Bella, the horse they had planned to buy together, and who Georgia eventually came to own. Georgia would say Bella meant everything to her, that the small horse was her last touchstone to her mother. Georgia would wonder if maybe she could have forgiven her father, if only he had told the truth about that day, if he had admitted it and said he was sorry. But he never did. To her, her father orchestrated a lie and went on living his life as though that day had never happened. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode. That email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. Or if you are on Instagram, you can follow us on @linesofinquirypodcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, leaving a rating or review really helps. We've now received almost 5,000 five-star ratings across Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Those responses make a real difference. They help new listeners find the series, and I am genuinely humbled by the response we've gotten. Thank you. Your support helps us to tell these stories. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Maguire and Siobhan Walsh. Sound editing and design is by Neil Kavanagh, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. This episode was written by Siobhan Maguire and edited by Owen Brennan. Social media, marketing, video, and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.